This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. In a few minutes, we'll talk about what we learned from Attorney General Curtis Hill's disciplinary hearings last week, what it all means, and what comes next. But first, a quick update on the news over the weekend. A number of Indiana politicians have commented on President Trump's announcement yesterday that ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead after U.S. Special Forces launched a raid in Syria. Indiana Senator Todd Young sits on the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. In a statement, the Republican senator calls the news, quote, a watershed moment in the battle against terrorism, end quote. Young also mentions Hoosiers who've made sacrifices in the fight against ISIS, including Peter Kasich, who was killed in 2014 while doing aid work in Syria. Republican Representative Susan Brooks thanked U.S. Special Forces and the president in a tweet for what she calls an historic operation. And Democratic Congressman Andre Carson sent us a statement this morning. In it, he says that the announcement is welcome news. He also says, quote, but our fight against ISIS is far from over, particularly in the wake of the president's decision to remove troops from northern Syria, which could lead to a revival of the terrorist group's power in the region. I'm also concerned that foreign countries, including an historic adversary like Russia, were informed of the raid before Democratic lawmakers. This administration must deliver a strong, decisive, and committed strategy to ensure ISIS is defeated permanently, end quote from Andre Carson. Stay with your NPR station for the latest as we continue to learn more about this story. Now, back to our topic today. We're talking about the controversy surrounding Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill. He's been accused of sexual misconduct and spent some of last week in a series of disciplinary hearings where he gave his side of the story for the first time. We'll talk about the whole story today and the ongoing process that will decide what, if anything, happens. Do you have questions about how that process works? What do you think of the accusations against Hill and his response to them? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we'll get your questions and comments to our live panel today. Joining me in the studio are two reporters who spent a lot of time in those hearings last week. Indianapolis Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith. Thanks for coming on, Brandon.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
And from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette, reporter Nikki Kelly. Nikki, thanks for taking the time.
No problem.
You've both been deep in this story for a long time now. You spent a lot of time there last week. I mean, you spend all your time there, but this was particularly rough, I would imagine. Let's use this as an opportunity to step back a little bit and catch everybody up. Nikki, how did we first find out about these allegations?
The allegations first came to light last July when someone had sort of let the Indianapolis Star know that there were some allegations out there and that the legislature had hired an outside law firm to sort of assess the situation. And then sort of out of nowhere, they also leaked the confidential memo, which detailed the allegations. So it was sort of, you know, a bombshell, like July 2nd, I think, that memo came out and everything happened from there.
And so what actually happened? This was a legislative session end party, right?
The actual party was in March of 2018, but this didn't come out, I guess, till May when the legislative leaders were told by staffers. And then in July, it got leaked. From there, we immediately heard the governor and other Republican leaders calling for Hill's resignation. He refused. It went to a special prosecutor who declined to file criminal charges. It also went through the inspector general, who's kind of looks at ethics violations. I think her report made clear the conduct was unacceptable, but didn't rise to the level of a violation. And then we all kind of thought it was over until the disciplinary commission, the Indiana Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission, filed a complaint earlier this year alleging he broke attorney conduct rules.
Yeah, this has taken months and months and months. So it was, you know, like Nikki said, it was the alleged incidents actually happened in March, and then legislative leaders found out in May. That investigative report happened. I say investigative report. Nikki probably described it a little better, in which they kind of assessed the situation really to make sure that legislative leaders didn't violate any employment rules. That was really what the report did. It didn't interview a lot of people. It just collected like notes from other interviews that legislative leaders and staffers had done with the women who were accusing Curtis Hill. So that happened sort of by the end of June, and then July it all comes out. And she said legislative leaders and the governor immediately called for Hill to resign.
Three days.
it took a few days for them to actually say he should resign after it became public. But then, I mean, the special prosecutor didn't make his announcement that he was not filing criminal charges until October of 2018.
A year ago.
And then we found out about the disciplinary complaint in
February or March of this year.
Yeah, earlier this year, towards the beginning of this year. So this is, I mean, it's really taken its time to get to where we are today.
Before we get too much deeper, just so we can make sure everyone knows, what does the state attorney general do, Brandon?
Oh, man.
I mean, it's a big job. But
well, Curtis Hill was asked that question and had some trouble at times answering it. He's considered the top legal officer of the state of Indiana. So the state attorney general's office, for one thing, defends the state in court proceedings. That's maybe the most forward thing. It's the thing that people think most of when they think of the attorney general. But they have a lot of different divisions, consumer fraud divisions, Medicaid fraud divisions. They work on drug abuse stuff through that office.
They also defend all criminal convictions. As soon as you're in your local county and you get a conviction, say for anything, rape, murder, whatever, it leaves the local county and the attorney general's office defends that up through the court system.
Right. If you appeal that sort of thing. He also defends counties and cities in lawsuits. So a lot of times when a city or county gets sued, it'll be the AG's office who kind of steps in and takes over that. There's a lot of different roles that the attorney general's office does.
He also has a degree of political power too.
I mean he's an independently elected official. So and he run and then the attorneys general in this state run for political parties. They're not nominated. The nominee for each party is not chosen by the public, unlike senator or governor. They're chosen by the state party conventions. So that'll happen in June of 2020, for instance. The Republicans and Democrats will each decide who they want their nominee to be. I wouldn't say that the AG has a lot of political power, no.
No, I mean they can decide sort of what lawsuits they want to get involved in and make sort of political statements that way if they want to sign on to, for instance, the national lawsuit to, you know, get rid of Obamacare. That's an example where you can see a little bit of politics.
Which Curtis Hill has done. Yeah. They can also send a message by choosing not to take part in a lawsuit. And I don't just mean at a national level. There was a somewhat of a controversy a few years ago where Attorney General Greg Zeller, a Republican, decided not to defend an Indiana immigration law because he, in his opinion, the U.S. Supreme Court had just ruled on one out of Arizona, and he believed that Indiana's law in parts violated that ruling. And so he just said, I'm not doing anything anymore. And some state senators tried to make him essentially do that, and they were unsuccessful in doing so. So there's a little bit of politicking involved in that.
So I don't think we've quite gotten to the actual allegations yet, if we could get to that. What were the allegations made against Curtis Hill, and how much did we know kind of early on?
Sure. The allegations were pretty clear from the beginning. A female lawmaker and three female legislative staffers accused him of touching them, I'll say, for lack of a better word, inappropriately, though that's obviously in the eye of the beholder, at a party following the legislative council, to be specific, touching their back, rubbing their back, touching their butt, making sexually suggestive comments like you have to show some skin to get a drink, that kind of thing.
Yikes. And what was his immediate response? So he denied it.
His immediate public response was denial, full denial. Behind closed doors, it depends on who you ask what his immediate response was, as we heard in the hearing last week. But it's mostly been denial throughout this year and a half long process.
When people called for him to resign, he said he wouldn't. He also called an internal legislative investigation into the allegations prejudicial. Do you know what he meant by that?
Well, I think what he meant, and this is what we were referencing earlier about the confidential memo, and the reason he, you know, wasn't happy with that, and to be fair to him, is because the women were interviewed for that, quote, report.
Not all of them, though.
Not all of them, but the four that were.
Well, but I mean, they weren't actually interviewed. They weren't interviewed by the person who compiled the report, which this was a very sloppy kind of situation.
Well, regardless of who interviewed them, Curtis Hill was not interviewed for that report in any way, shape, or manner.
Yeah, that's correct.
So his point was it was only one side of the story. It didn't provide context. He, of course, says, look, it was incidental conduct. It's a crowded bar. I can't hear out of my left ear. I lean in a lot, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm. So a special prosecutor was assigned to investigate this. Why was that?
So the matter was referred to the Marion County Prosecutor's Office, Terry Curry, at the time, which is normal for something that would happen in Indianapolis, of course. But Terry Curry immediately said, I'm represented by Curtis Hill and his office, mm-hmm. as we discussed earlier. I'm represented by his office sometimes. In fact, I think
there was a pending
case at the time in which Terry Curry's office was being represented by Curtis Hill's office. So he said, I have a conflict of interest. This needs to go to a special prosecutor. Not incredibly unusual for something of this nature, this high-profile nature involving a state officer. We saw that, I think, with the Charlie White case a few years earlier, Secretary of State Charlie White. So that's why Terry Curry asked a judge, hey, move this over to somebody who's not involved, and that's what they did.
And has Curtis Hill faced any tangible consequences for this so far? Other than public
opinion, no. Now, to be fair, though, we don't know how his fundraising is going because there, you know, since he's not up this year, there haven't really been reports filed. So it might be hurting him on that level. We just don't know yet.
And we won't know if – I mean, there could be consequences he faces over the next months to a year or so, but we won't know those until a month and a year.
Got about a minute left. All four women also sued Curtis Hill and the state in federal court earlier this summer. What was the nature of that lawsuit?
There are a few things. They're asking for some money, but they also want some – part of the reason they sued the state was they want better sexual harassment policies and procedures for reporting such in place at the state house in general.
Has anything happened yet?
No.
From that?
No, I think they were waiting to see how the disciplinary hearing goes.
And can you explain – let's see. How meaningful is it then when state officials say that they're calling for someone to resign? How much pressure does that really put on the person?
So far, none.
Yeah. I think it put a lot of pressure on him for about a week. But once you weather that initial sort of – you know, tied, it hasn't put much pressure on him at all.
The question will be, you know, in next June when he's – if and when he is trying to get the nomination to be attorney general – to run for attorney general again at the Republican convention, will it matter to those convention delegates that the governor and legislative leaders all told him to get out?
We're talking to Brandon Smith from Indiana Public Broadcasting and Nikki Kelly from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette about sexual misconduct allegations made against Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill. Up next, we'll dive into what happened last week during a multi-day series of disciplinary hearings, and we'll talk about what happens next. As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on the ongoing controversy around Attorney General Curtis Hill, I want to tell you about our last show. We end every week with the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on some of the biggest Indiana headlines of the week. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In Indiana. Today, we're talking about Attorney General Curtis Hill. He's facing four groping allegations that culminated in a series of disciplinary hearings last week. As always, we'll love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio, we're joined again by two reporters who've been covering this story. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith. Thanks, Brandon.
Thank you.
And Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette reporter Nikki Kelly. Thanks for sticking around. So what were the disciplinary hearings that happened last week? What was their purpose?
Well, basically, it was almost kind of just like a trial. I mean, you know, the prosecution, quote, put on their witnesses, the defense put on their witnesses. So we'll start with the prosecution. The first day was the four women, the accusers, and, you know, them detailing very specific wording and, you know, was how did his hand touch you? Did it go down your back? Was it there 30 seconds? Was it there 2 minutes? It was just very specific testimony about what they saw and felt in those moments.
And was any new information brought to light last Monday during those parts?
I would say no on that day, only because we had already heard the women's general allegations in the initial report and then the special prosecutor report and then the inspector general report and the lawsuit. So we had already heard from them in various ways. So there wasn't so much new information there.
I think for those of us who've been covering this the whole time, the thing that stuck out to me on Monday was just hearing them say it themselves, because we really hadn't had that opportunity yet.
And everyone's in the room, right? Curtis Hill is in the room.
Curtis Hill's
well.
In the room. The rest of the women came in one at a time. All of the witnesses were separated out like you would a lot of times in a regular trial. But Curtis Hill was in the room the whole time.
Gabrielle Brock, one of the accusers, says she regrets coming forward on the allegations. Why did she say she felt that way?
She said that – not always, but she said she sometimes regrets coming forward because Curtis Hill hasn't faced any consequences for what she says he did.
How did Curtis Hill's attorneys handle this first day? What was their strategy?
They objected a lot, which is their job, and they were – from what I can tell, pretty good at it. There was a lot of focus, and I think this hit people a little uncomfortably. There was a lot of focus on how Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon was dressed, the fact that she put on sort of a fancy dress for this party. It was backless. They kept bringing that up again and again. And I think that was certainly, you know, right on the edge of sort of blaming the victim.
Yeah. And part of the objections and the fighting over that illustrated how this was very much like a trial, but not quite, because it's important to separate out really a regular criminal trial and what the disciplinary commission complaint was about, because there are very different burdens of proof there. And a lot of the objections were about hearsay. So I heard this person tell me this. I heard this person say this about that. In a normal criminal trial, a lot of that testimony probably wouldn't have been allowed. But here, it was – not all the time, but it was often allowed by the hearing officer, former State Supreme Court Justice Myra Selby, because as the prosecution, as the disciplinary commission put it, we are not offering this for the truth of the statement, but merely to prove that, you know, one of the things that Curtis Hill and his team alleged throughout the process is that there was some sort of like – collusion, conspiracy between the four women to get him, essentially. And they were trying to show that, no, they told a bunch of people about what they said happened, like the night of or the next day kind of thing.
And a lot of people testified the next day on Tuesday, the second day of the hearings. Were these all the same people who attended the party?
Many of them were at the party. And,
witnesses.
And I found that day's testimony to be sort of even more important because they were corroborating witnesses. They were people who saw that, saw him touch her or, you know, that kind of thing.
Maybe or said, you know, like I just mentioned, said, you know, she came up to me within minutes and said, you won't believe what the attorney general just did kind of thing.
Yeah. So those witnesses were very interesting, including I know there was one. Well, I think it might have came out on the first day, but in Brandon example, you know, one of the witnesses immediately texting a friend who happened to work for Attorney General Hill saying, your boss just touched my butt, you know.
Touched other women too. Like she referenced other people in that same text message the night of or the next morning.
Yeah.
How solid did that testimony seem?
I mean, who am I to say how solid the testimony was? The unknown factor here is, you know, this wasn't before a jury. We aren't going to find out for probably months, even what the former Justice Selby's recommendation is on Curtis Hill. So, how compelling did she find some of this? We don't know. Again, you're not following the letter of a criminal law here, where some of that is a little more cut and dried. The disciplinary commission policies and rules for conduct are a little more gray, a little more amorphous.
Well,
I mean, there are specific words,
yeah.
But, you know.
And, you know, we're used to in our mind thinking beyond a reasonable doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt. That is not the level of evidence that is in this case. It is a lower burden called clear and convincing evidence. So it doesn't have to be beyond a reasonable doubt for him to be found guilty of some sanction.
Was there consensus from this group of witnesses, or was it kind of a mix of interpretations? You mentioned corroboration.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is that there are four or five different incidents here being alleged, so not everybody saw everything. Nobody saw everything.
Right.
You had some differing opinions of what Curtis Hill was like that night, for instance. His level of intoxication varied a little bit depending on who you were asking. Mm. Although I'll note that witness after witness after witness from day one to day through day three of these hearings described Curtis Hill as pretty drunk. Impaired was often a word used in response to a question. Drunk, swaying, bloodshot eyes, smelling of alcohol. And then we got to Curtis Hill, who said he really wasn't drunk at all. He'd had a couple of drinks and that was it. So that didn't line up at all to me, which surprised me when Curtis Hill finally did testify that they didn't just – because person after person after person had described him as such. So.
Well, and especially since on day three – we got legislative leaders, House Speaker Brian Bosma, Senate President Pro Tem David Long, who's since left. And they described an initial conference call with Curtis Hill when they told him about this, quote, investigation. And they said he was very conciliatory, that he said right off, wow, I had too much to drink. I didn't mean to offend anyone if I did. And he, you know, so that was very different than how he testified about it.
And that is not how Curtis Hill describes that conversation going. I mean – any sort of case – not any sort of case, but a lot of cases of sexual misconduct often boil down to he said, she said, or some version of that. This is – this seemed like over the course of the 4 days, it seemed an awful lot like he said, they said, which is Curtis Hill says one thing and a lot of different people say something very, very different.
A lot of different – 4 women from 2 political parties and corroborating witnesses say something very different.
And a new allegation came out on the third day. Right. What was that?
That was, I would say, the bombshell of the week. We hadn't heard. So this was a former employee of Curtis Hill's when he was the Elkhart County prosecutor. She worked in that office as a victim advocate. Not directly. At no point did she have a direct professional relationship with Curtis Hill, but he was the prosecutor. And we had never heard from this woman before. She basically came forward for the disciplinary commission hearing. She reached out to the disciplinary commission to make this it's the sense we got to make this complaint. And she said that when she was his employee in late 2016, so just literally a couple weeks before he became the attorney general, after he was elected, before he was sworn in, that he made an explicit sexual advance to her that made her incredibly uncomfortable. She found incredibly inappropriate. So that was the first we'd heard anything of that. And the Curtis Hill's attorneys objected to, well, what relevance does this woman have on a legislative session, end of session party in March of 2018? And the disciplinary commission's response was, well, it tells you something about his pattern of conduct. This wasn't an isolated incident in March of 2018. It's something, you know, there's something relevant that he had done in the past. And so that was, I think, the most surprising and shocking thing of the 4 days of the week.
A statement to his character, perhaps. And so 5 accusers. But witnesses were also called for his defense on day 3. How many people were in this group and who were they?
If I remember, it was 7 people.
Yeah. The difference in the witnesses, at least from what I saw, was – I mean, a lot of people came up and said, I didn't see anything. But like not in a sense of I saw the interaction with person A and I viewed it differently. Just I didn't see any interactions with anyone. So just because, you know, if you got 100+ people in the bar, you know, just because this person didn't see anything doesn't mean that thing didn't happen. So his witnesses, I don't think, were as helpful because they just didn't see anything. It's not that they saw it differently.
This is a bit of an exaggerated comparison, but it would be something akin to me going to Wrigley Field for a Cubs game and there's a fight in the bleachers. But I'm sitting on the third base side watching the game and somebody brought me to testify about that fight. I would say I have no earthly idea what happened in the bleachers at the Cubs game that I happened to attend. That's a bit of an exaggeration. Obviously, this is not Wrigley Field. It is a relatively small little neighborhood bar. But yeah, I think we kind of expected people to come up and say, well, I saw them together and I didn't see anything improper. And instead it was, well, I wasn't really paying attention to anyone. That's literally one lawmaker who was called to testify who was at the party that night said, well, I don't really pay attention to other people when I'm at parties. I don't like parties. I don't like crowds.
Now, to be fair, he did have one key witness on his behalf, Tony Samuel, who was the lobbyist who invited him along that night. And Tony has a completely different view of what happened. And they also, you know, Ubered home together. So he says, you know, in the car afterward that Curtis Hill was fine and he wasn't slurring or anything like that. He says he didn't see anything like that, but even better, he said it couldn't have happened because he would have heard about it. People would have been talking about it in the bar.
That was one version. The other version is that – or not version, but that was one reason. The second reason that Tony Samuels said it didn't happen is because if it had happened, if what these women said Curtis Hill had done, he had done for – I'm using Tony Samuels' words now – sexual gratification, Curtis Hill would have touched them a lot more, which is an interesting defense.
Yeah. That's did anyone though any of those defense witnesses say they saw it and didn't see it as improper, or did they pretty much all say we didn't see anything?
Or they would say they saw part of it, like there. I think there was one person who saw Curtis from the front put his arm around Representative Reardon, but they couldn't see his hand on the back, so they wouldn't know if his hand went down to her. But that was the kind of thing you got. Maybe they saw part of it, but not all of it.
And again, as Nikki mentioned earlier, none of those witnesses said, I saw it. It didn't happen like all of these people say. It was, I don't know.
Okay, so Thursday, the final day of the hearings, Curtis Hill tells his side of the story. How did he describe what happened at the party?
Denial. He explained away one of the suggestive remarks as being a joke directed not to a group of women at the bar, but instead to the bartender, who was a state lawmaker, Greg Taylor. He said in some cases it was they didn't interpret it the right way. In other cases, it was I didn't, you know, like, for instance, one of the victims, Gabrielle Brock, said that he rubbed her hand for a little, like he rubbed back. He rubbed her back. Thank you. He says, oh, no, I didn't touch her back. I touched her shoulder at most. Things like that. I didn't put my arm around them. You know, I with Representative Reardon, who made the most she was the one who said Curtis Hill touched her the most, which was that in her words, and I hope I can say this on the air, which is he grabbed a handful of ass, is what Representative Reardon multiple times described the encounter as like. And Curtis Hill said, I touched her back for a moment just to lean in and talk with her, noticed it was backless and took my hand away immediately. So that's – I mean that's really
another
far
example
apart.
Was with Nikki Da Silva, another one of the accusers was he was helping guide her to an open spot at the bar so she could get a drink, you know, just kind of put your arm around the back and guide her in. Those were – the kinds of things he made very clear to say he didn't touch them in a rude, insolent, or angry manner and not for sexual gratification. And the purpose of those that wording is because those are the words used in Indiana criminal battery statutes.
And to say what Nikki Da Silva said actually happened is he put his arm around her and then slid his hand down to her butt. She tried to brush his hand away and he grabbed her hand and put it on her butt. Or not. We don't know.
Well, he said during his testimony that he was convinced that this was all a political attack on him. What convinced him of that?
I think when the memo got leaked and he was not a part of, you know, or able to give his side at that point, that is when his entire demeanor changed. At least that was the testimony, is that suddenly he was like, oh, no, this is out in the public and now I'm going to fight it.
And he did say – he did say that that's the moment where he said he suspected it had become a political attack.
Did he respond at all to the new allegation that had been put forth the day before?
He did. He largely denied that it happened the way the woman in Elkhart said it happened. The explicit sexual advance is a word I cannot say on the air. But he said that he phrased it very differently, and it was referring to something they could have done together, a dance at a charity event a couple years or a year before the allegation happened.
And we referred to the quote, I think, on the Friday pitch-in with Lauren Chapman, and she gave a censored quote of what was said from that accuser. But I guess what happens next? What's the timeline we're looking at from here on out?
We're looking at a long time. There are certain deadlines to A, prepare the record, B, file briefs before the judge, then for the judge, Judge Selby, to issue a recommendation. Then they can, you know, petition against the recommendation. Then the Indiana Supreme Court gets involved to make their say. And they have no timeline at all for the Supreme Court.
Judge Selby doesn't technically have a timeline. No. The Supreme Court really doesn't have a timeline. So I've sort of been doing back of the napkin math on this. I would be shocked if we get Justice Selby's recommendation before March I think that would be about in line as to like the beginning of March, end of February.
What could happen to Curtis Hill because of this?
Anything from nothing or a public reprimand, basically a slap on the wrist, probation, which sometimes has some rules that go, you know, you have to go through anger management training or something like that. Or he could have his license suspended. Now, technically, disbarment is also on the table, but I don't think anybody believes that that's a possibility. So suspension of his license would be probably the most severe thing he would be likely to face. And even that, I think, is unlikely.
And the reason the suspension is very important is to be attorney general, you have to have a valid law license. So if he was suspended for any period of time, there could be a legal argument about whether that constitutes a vacancy in the office.
Based on what you saw at last week, all of last week, you were very busy. Do you think anything will happen to him?
I have maintained my prediction going into the hearings and my prediction coming out of the hearings is I think at most he gets a public reprimand from the Supreme Court, which has no actual like functional penalty attached to it.
And if I were wagering, I would go slightly above that with some probation and some sort of like-minded regulations.
Lots of details to go over. We really appreciate both of you coming in to break it all down for us. Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Nikki Kelly, government politics reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Thanks for joining us, Nikki.
Glad to be here.
Up next, more on a free service for Indiana middle school and high school students in its 28th year, Rose Holman's Ask Rose program. If the second half of the fall semester means panic for a student you might know, this could really help them out. Stay close. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. School is in session, and I can remember when I was in school, and I had an appreciation for math. But I often had trouble understanding it. If you have a child in the same scenario and you yourself aren't much help, just as I know I probably won't be when my kids are that age, you might want to pay attention for the next 15 minutes. Joining me in studio are a couple people involved with a program called Ask Rose at Rose Holman Institute of Technology in Terre Haute. Program tutor Helen Dones, mechanical engineering major from Plainfield. Good afternoon, Helen.
Hello.
And Associate Director Lindsay Hull. Thanks
Hello.
For being here.
Thanks for having us.
So, Lindsay, Ask Rose is a math and science tutoring helpline for middle school and high school students in Indiana who are stumped on their homework. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah. We have been around since 1991. We started as just a hotline, but we now provide help via chat and email as well. And kids call us with all kinds of questions, from your basic elementary math questions all the way up to the AP calculus and even some that are already taking college classes, your sciences as well, the middle school science all the way through all the AP level sciences.
But it goes beyond homework a little bit, right? I mean, could a student approach it as a study supplement when gearing up for a test or a project?
Absolutely. Students contact us just for homework questions. But, you know, when they know they're going to have a test over quadratics, they call and ask for some extra helps and tips to handle quadratics and some practice problems, that sort of thing. And we're happy to help them with it.
And this isn't a give me the answer kind of service. This is these tutors really work to help students grasp the concepts they're working out, right?
Yes. We pride ourselves on the fact that we do not give out answers. So I used to be a high school math teacher. And in training, I train all of our tutors. So in training, I'm always talking to them about we don't care what the right answer is. You know, I used to tell my students when I was teaching, it's all fake. I made these problems up. I care that you understand the process and that when you're in a real life situation where you need to use this math, that you understand the process. So we're the same way when we're helping students, whether it's phone, chat, or email. We care about making sure they understand the process. So we're never just going to give an answer out. We're going to say, if you call just to check your answer, we're going to say, tell me how you did that. Tell me how you got to that so that I know that you understand the math or the science that's happening here and not just the answer.
Yeah. And so education isn't necessarily something that is intuitive to some people. And these are math and science and engineering students. Mm-hmm. But you kind of have to teach how to educate. In what ways do you equip these tutors to do exactly that?
So we talk about lots of different things in training. We talk about different ways of learning. We talk about how the brain develops and how the brain works so that when you're dealing with a sixth grader versus when you're dealing with a senior in high school, that they're going to understand things differently, that concrete versus abstract, and how the brain processes information, how age, how development play into all of that, so that the tutors are equipped to help the wide range of students that we get.
Helen, give me an example of that. What's a problem that you've helped with recently or at any point when you've been doing this, and how did you approach it to help the student fully understand the concept?
A lot lately, I think I've been working on some algebra problems, so like solving for variables in simple equations. And I usually just help, like, because the objective of those questions is to get X by itself or get whatever variable you're looking for by itself. And so and you just do it step by step to get all of the other numbers and variables onto the other side of the equation.
Do you sort of try your best to make sure before you go on to the next step that they've got it?
Yeah.
And are there ways that you can tell when they say they've got it, but they really don't?
Yeah, well, usually they'll be like, I'm like, do you understand? And they say, yeah, or sure. And I'm like, do you really understand it? So they like go back and go over it again if I can tell that they don't.
What is perhaps the an example of a long call or a chat that you've had where it just took a while to get them to get it, but you got there?
Mm-hmm. The chats are kind of, it's a little bit more difficult to explain things over a chat because you can't fully explain it like in your words as much.
And so when you're dealing with something like that, you kind of have to draw it out yourself.
Yes, I do that all the time.
You got graph paper in front of you. And
yeah.
Lindsay, you're a former high school math teacher. You taught at Center Grove High School in Greenwood. Mm-hmm. How important is homework to the learning process?
I think it's very important. And there's, you know, I think we see stories and articles about homework all over the place. And I think it's important to realize that those are very age dependent. So I see people sharing on social media the articles about how we shouldn't do any homework. I'm like, yes, but that is for the elementary age group. As students get older, they need the homework. They need to do that practice. And they need independent practice where they're trying it on their own. So there's a big difference between sitting in a classroom and having a teacher show you an example and trying it on your own and struggling through that problem on your own. So I find homework very valuable because it shows the students what they know and what they don't know, what they still need to get help on. And then that's where we come in. So they start their homework and they get through a problem and they get to a point where they're stuck. And then they can contact us and we can provide them that guidance as to where they're stuck to clarify that learning that they had in the classroom with the teacher. But without the homework, you know, type down what the teacher wrote on the board or on the smart screen or whatever. And you're like, yeah, I got that. And then if you never do homework, you never try it again on your own to make sure that you got it and that you understand it. So especially at that high school level and in the middle school level, it's crucial to their learning and what they're doing there.
Yeah, because homework is almost universally disliked and for perfectly understandable reasons. You want to go home, you want to relax, you want to disconnect a little bit.
Yes.
But when it comes to the later years, the middle school and the high school years, it becomes a lot more important. What are the arguments against homework? I've seen the same things or perhaps the same things that you have seen. Mm-hmm. Why do people not like homework other than it's just not fun?
It takes time. It takes away. We are such a busy society now. You know, when I was teaching, I had kids that would be on a high school athletic team. They might be in season for basketball, but playing club volleyball, and they're in student council, and they volunteer somewhere else, and they babysit, and there's just a million other things grabbing at our time. And so who wants to sit and do math homework, unless you're me and love math? Who wants to sit and do math homework when there's all those other things going on? At the younger age, I think the argument tends to be, you know, let them be kids, which I think there's some validity to that argument at the elementary school levels. And so I think it doesn't have to be hours and hours of homework. We don't want, there are lots of other things happening in the world, but it's important that despite all those other things that are more fun than doing your homework for some people, some of us love it. All those things that are more fun, it's important that you take a little bit of time and do that practice and finish that learning activity that you're in.
And regarding back to the Ask Rose mm-hmm. program, we're not talking about some ragtag bunch of college kids sitting in a room with nothing better to do. These are tutors specifically recommended by mm-hmm. Rose faculty? How do they choose who might be good for this kind of work?
Based on what they see in classes. Yep. Just keeping an eye out, seeing how they work with other classmates, seeing how they do in class, that sort of thing.
So it's a variety of factors. It's not just they're really good at this, and right. So they might be good. It's also communication skills.
Absolutely. Just because you're good at math doesn't mean you're good at explaining it to somebody else, or just because you really love physics and understand all the principles there doesn't mean that you're going to explain it. I often ask tutors and or potential tutors in interview, you know, tell me about a time when you've struggled academically, because the person you're going to be talking to is going to be struggling. So tell me about a time when you had a hard time doing your homework, whatever subject it is, so that you understand where that person on the other end of the phone or the other end of the chat is coming from, and you can help them figure it out. Like somebody hopefully helped you.
Yeah. In addition to being recommended, these tutors are then trained. Do you do that?
Yes, I do the training.
Oh, okay.
And then they also work with current tutors. So they'll shadow current tutors, because tutoring over the phone is definitely a little different than tutoring in person. So all of our tutors do an initial training with me. And then they do observations in our tutoring center, where they're just paired up with a mentor tutor for a few nights to learn how, you know, how we have a software program that runs the calls and the chats and all that, to learn that, but also to see what it's like, so that they've heard some phone calls, seen some chats before they go into it, so that they're ready to help. And then we do ongoing trainings throughout the year. We meet on a regular basis and do some trainings with our whole tutoring staff.
What's in it for the tutors? What do they get out of this?
So for them, it is a campus job. We are funded through the Lilly Endowment. So that is one piece of it. But they can choose a lot of campus jobs. You know, we're not the only job that they could take. And so for a lot of them, it's that they enjoy helping others. They know when they struggled and somebody helped them. And so they want to give back. They enjoy that moment. If you've ever taught anybody anything, in that moment, we call it the aha moment, like when the light bulb clicks and they get it, like, it's a wonderful feeling for everybody involved, the person who figured it out and the person that helped them figure it out. So there's lots of great reasons. I think it's also this program that we're doing right now, where we bring our tutors back early. It's one of my favorite things that we do, because it's fun to watch the friendships form. Like, we get to see each other in a different light. It's not the stress of Rose Holman courses. So you're got all your homework and exams happening in addition to work. It's, we're all here. We're starting, we come back 3 weeks early to be able to be open, since everybody but us is already in session, you know? So it's fun that they, it's a great thing to be involved in on campus. So it's like another club, another organization. It's not just a job when they come to work at Ask Rose.
But Helen, as a job, it beats picking up trash or hanging up posters, right?
Definitely.
Helen, what's a common request? What subjects do you find kids need the most help with?
Algebra and geometry are really the ones that I get the most. Mm-hmm. Geometry is always kind of weird, because there's always reproving things, and that's the first time usually that you've encountered that, and so students just don't always understand it.
That was where I had trouble. And that's what's frustrating to me, is knowing that when I was in high school that this service was in service, you know, and I wish I would have known about it. Lindsay, when you were teaching, did you recommend this service?
Yeah. So we for years have always sent pencils to schools. So we order 300,000 pencils, 350,000 pencils, and then we hire interns. Helen was one of our interns this summer, and that was one of their projects, is to get the pencils ready to ship out to schools. So I was always giving out the pencils. We always had the posters, rulers, that sort of thing. So I knew about it, but when I was in high school, I didn't know about it then. So when I was teaching, I knew about it. And then one year, one of my Algebra 1 students, we were doing homework and they were helping each other, and she did it a way I'd never shown them. I'm like, how do you know that? Where'd you see that? She's like, I called Ask Rose. We were homework hotline back then. She's like, I called them. I was like, and how was it? Because I always recommend it, but I'd never called, you know? And she's like, it was really great. They helped me with all my questions, and they said there's another way I could do it if I wanted, and they showed me this way, and now I can do it both ways. And so, like, from then on, I was like, guys, it really works. Like, I know now. I've had people come back and talk to me about it. And so yeah, as a teacher, I always recommended it.
Well, and when you were teaching, what were some of the subjects that you felt like you wanted just a little bit more time to explain? Like, what specifically did your students typically struggle with?
Well, I wanted more time on every subject.
Yeah, right.
There's never enough time.
Never.
So I taught AP Calculus when I was teaching. I taught pre-algebra, Algebra 1, Geometry, and AP Calculus. But for a lot of the AP Calculus kids, it was the first time they'd ever struggled with math. They were, I mean, they made it to calculus, so they're usually pretty good at math. But that's one of the points where if you've never struggled before, that's for a lot of people where they start. It was for me when I was a student. If you told me when I was in high school I was going to wind up, when I was in high school taking AP Calculus that I would teach it someday, I'd have told you you were crazy. But particularly on that, because they're used to, that group of students is used to being really good at it, not having to put in a ton of work. And so to get that extra help, I think was important for them. But across all levels, because at some point math's going to get hard for everybody. There's going to be something where it was easy. You were really good at adding and subtracting, and now you have to divide, and it came out of left field for you.
Is there something that, say, a college student has on, say, a teacher or a parent? Is there an extra level of respect that they're maybe granted? Maybe like the tutors are seen more as peers or maybe mm-hmm. just as slightly older mentors?
Yeah, I think it's definitely respect, but I think also a level of comfort, safety type of thing, like, they're not talking to a teacher or to a professor. They're calling somebody who's still in school and was just where they were a couple years ago. You know, Helen's going to be a junior. So she was just at Plainfield High School a few years ago as a student. So a level of familiarity and comfort there, I think, goes a long way.
Now, this is a private service. You know, you don't ask for last names or anything right. like that. I mean, there's no reason to, really. But have you ever made such an impact on a particular student that they kept up with you? Maybe they enrolled in Rose and you were able to follow their academic and then professional careers? Or is it just like, here you go, here's the help, bye, good luck?
For the most part, it's here you go, here's the help. My favorite is when we get emails or Facebook messages. One time a family from the Shipshawana area sent us baked goods from their local bakery because, you know, the parents were trying to help the kid and they didn't know how to do it. And so they called, and for us, it was easy because that's what we do all the time. And so they were just so thankful. You know, we get the calls, you know, my child was in tears last night and I couldn't help them. And, you know, for a parent, that's all you want to do is help your kid and mm-hmm. make your kid's life easier and better. And so when, as a parent, you can't do that, but there's someone that can step in and help you easily do that, it makes a big difference. We have had some callers. I love to ask, that's one of the other questions I love to ask in the interview is, did you ever call as a student? So we've had several. We had one, we celebrated our 25th anniversary a few years ago, and we had a tutor. Her name was Hannah, and she was from the Bloomington area. And she had some trouble with her algebra homework in eighth grade, and she'd missed some school, I think. And so she asked her teacher for help the next day. And the teacher said, you know, have you called Rose Holman? And so that night she did, and we helped her. And so then she kept calling. And then because she was succeeding in her math and science classes, like, she got really interested in them. And so, like, eighth grade was a fantastic time for her to call for the first time because that's, like, that's really a kind of a fork in the road as to what classes, which way you're going to go in high school. And so she ended up coming to Rose, and she majored in mechanical engineering. And she, like, the first day she was on campus, came to my office and was like, I want to work here. I'm like, okay, who are you? Let's talk about this. So so those kinds of stories are great when it's people that have used us and had a great experience, and then they end up coming to Rose.
Let's get the basics down. Hours are weekdays from 7 to 10 Eastern.
Sunday through Thursday.
Sunday through Thursday.
Yep.
So no Fridays or Saturdays.
Correct. There's not a lot of homework happening there.
I wouldn't want to work then either. That's peak homework time. It's free, of course, thanks mm-hmm. in part to the Lilly Endowment.
Yes.
What else? How do students get a hold of you?
So they can contact us by phone at 877-ASK-ROSE. So that's 877-275-7673. Or they can go to our website, which is askrose.org. You can also find us through the Rose Holman website. If you search for Ask Rose or Homework Hotline, which is what our name used to be, you can find us that way. And then students can pick whatever the way they want to contact us. So if they like phone, if they like chat, if they're in the middle of a chat and say, hey, can I talk to you? Then they can call and get connected to the person that they were just talking to. So they can contact us whatever their preferred mode is.
And Helen, what's your preferred mode? Do you prefer to talk to people on the phone, or is chat better?
I like the phone just because it is easier to communicate the problem. Like,
you can kind of get it done quicker too, right?
Yeah. Definitely.
Associate Director of Ask Rose at Rose Holman Institute of Technology, Lindsay Hull, thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you.
And Helen Dones, thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow when we'll talk to the mother of Ryan White, the Indiana teenager whose HIV diagnosis in the 80s advanced the conversation around AIDS in the U.S. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.